It's time now for another installment of the Cell Podcast. I'm Cyrus Martin, Associate Editor of Current Biology, and I'll be your host. Today we have an interesting mix of material from three journals at Cell Press. First, we'll be hearing about a paper and review in Neuron dealing with the question of how we use the sense of touch to locate objects in our environment. Next, we'll turn to a paper out at Cell Stem Cell that identifies a signaling molecule that seems to be important for the heart to repair itself in the face of disease or injury. Finally, we'll hear about a review in Trends in Immunology on the flu vaccine and what is being done to develop more effective vaccines for the future. Please stay tuned. Katya Broz, editor of Neuron, spoke earlier with David Kleinfeld, an author of both a recent paper in Neuron and a review that is part of Neuron's latest special issue on motor systems. David is specifically interested in the intimate relationship between the movement of sensors and the perception of objects in the environment. Katya, take it away.
Sensation is an active process. As we engage with our environment, whether it's by sight, hearing, or touch, there's a constant interplay between sensory inputs and motor outputs. As you look around, your eyes are constantly moving, taking in the visual scene and readjusting in the process. When you reach into your pocket to search for your cell phone, the touch receptors in your hand and fingers scan and pick up the surfaces and textures, signaling back to your brain and providing feedback to your motor cortex, which signals back and redirects the movements of your hand and fingers to optimize your search. So what are the neural mechanisms that mediate this fine interplay between your sensory and motor systems? So today we're talking to David Kleinfeld from the University of California, San Diego. The Kleinfeld Lab works on a number of areas related to neural coding and behavior, and for many years has been using the rodent, vibrissa, and whisking system to address questions related to the circuits in the brain that are used by an animal to explore and engage with its environment. In a recently published paper from Daniel Hill, John Curtis, Jeff Moore, and David Kleinfeld in the October 20th issue of Neuron, the authors address questions related to how the primary motor cortex contributes to active sensing of touch in rat whisking behavior. David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Since many of our listeners today are not neuroscientists, they may not be familiar with the rodent vibrissa system and with whisking behavior. So can you tell us a little bit about the vibrissa system and whisking and why this is such an excellent system for exploring questions related to sensory motor coding?
We really have a bias this way. There's two aspects of this. From a neuroethological perspective, you want to choose your animal such that a particular behavior dominates its worldview. And rodents are nocturnal animals, and they burrow, and they have to detect objects at very close distances. And at these close distances, stereopsis in the visual system breaks down. So you're really forced to see the world by banging with little sticks, which are exactly what the vibrissa system has. It just has a sea of hairs that will sense objects within 2 or 3 centimeters in front of the animal. Now, the other reason that we like the rodent vibrissa system is the issue of standard tools. So the thrust of certainly the last decade of work has been focused, well, heavily on the mouse, I mean, not just on the mouse, to develop transgenics, which means you could get access to particular neural subtypes. Plus, you have a range of tools that you could use to activate and inactivate neurons. The third aspect really has to do with some fortunate accidents of nature, you would say, in the way the vibrissa system is designed. The motor aspects, the motor nerve, and the sensory nerve separate, which makes it unique. And this allows you to do manipulation, say, turn off the motor drive to whisking and see what happens to the sensation, or break the sensory input and see what happens to the motor control. So we're kind of sold for these three reasons.
It's an amazing system. In addition to your paper in the October 20th issue, you also wrote a very nice review for the November 3rd issue of Neuron, which lays out many of these ideas in a broader overview. This review is a part of a series of reviews and perspectives on motor systems in that issue. As I alluded to in the introduction, active sensing isn't just a property of touch and somatosensation. And it's interesting to see that this is becoming more of an active, and here the pun is intended, research area for other modalities as well. There's been some interesting research recently on sniffing behavior in the olfactory system and licking and taste. Do you think that you could see similar principles as applying?
Let me pick up on sniffing, which is interesting. So sniffing, like whisking, is a oral facial behavior. And so there's sort of two aspects. One sort of immediate thing is that in the vibrissa system, the coding of sensory input is really tied to the back and forth motion of the vibrissa, what we call the phase of the motion, just going around on a clock. And what was recently found in the olfactory system, this is the work of Dima Rydberg, is that olfactory input is also timed to the clock of breathing. Now, many years ago, Wally Welker, in some ways is really the grand old man of all this active sensing in the vibrissa system, made the observation that sniffing, which is like fast breathing, mm-hmm. and whisking are synchronized. And actually, my co-author, Martin Duchenne, and one of the grad students in my lab, Jeff Bohr, have been looking into this. And so it looks like it could be the breathing clock, which is really this global clock.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And we'll see how this all pans out.
It's a really interesting area. You mentioned earlier in the conversation about some of the recent technological innovations, and it does seem that we just, especially in mice, have now a really extensive toolbox for probing neural systems. For instance, all of these new electrophysiological and imaging approaches for recording neural activity in either single cells or across populations, optogenetics for manipulating circuits, and especially in your field, new automated behavioral approaches.
Uh-huh.
And they're really giving us a detailed view of behaviors. And every time I hear about one of these techniques, I just think that it must be like being a kid in the candy store to be a neuroscientist these days. What do you think are the big questions in your field that we can expect to see you guys tackle next?
First thing, you know, I'm very interested in these sort of control theory ideas of how sensory input actually modulates motor output. There's really only sort of pop psychology clues at the moment. I'm not sure if at the end of the day there's going to be some great aha, as opposed uh-huh. to saying, gee, this makes sense in terms of what we know from control theory. I think the great aha might be the fact that the animals, whether it's the whisker system with its sort of couple of dozen whiskers on each side, or maybe the visual system with many, many hundreds of thousands of photoreceptors, you have this massive input of data coming in. And at the end of the day, you make a binary decision. I'm going to mm-hmm. cross the street. I'm going to pick up my right. cell phone, as you alluded to at the beginning, because it's ringing. And that's the area where I don't think there's very much theoretical guidance.
Uh-huh.
So that may be, it may be modern technology, these various imaging techniques, they're complementary to measurements with wires in the sense that they miss a lot of spikes.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not yet appropriate for questions of detailed timing.
Mm-hmm.
But they do allow you to record from very many cells, as lots of people have shown nicely. And I think that could just lead to something that's very unexpected.
Well, thank you very much, David, for speaking with us today. It was really great. For listeners, if you're interested in learning more about this work, we'd invite you to read the Hill et al. Paper published in the October 20th issue and the review from Kleinfeld and Duchenne's just published in the November 3rd issue. Both issues of Neuron will be featured at the Society for Neuroscience meeting beginning November 12th, and we'd invite anyone interested to stop by the Elsevier Cell Press booth, booth number 1424, to pick up your free copies. We hope to see you at the neuroscience meeting.
Thanks, Katya. And now a special announcement from Cell Press.
What do you need to know about speciation? Join the debate in our discussion forum, hosted by Trends in Ecology and Evolution, by visiting discussions.cell.com today.
Next, we turn to the subject of regeneration and the potential of the heart to renew itself in the face of injury or disease. A recent paper in Cell Stem Cell identifies a signaling molecule that seems to allow dedifferentiation of cardiomyocytes and speeds recovery after myocardial infarction, or heart attack. I'll turn it over now to Cell Stem Cell editor Christina Lilyhook, who has the story.
Zebrafish can do it, but mammals have limited capacity for heart repair after injury. Mammalian cardiomyocytes are instead known to undergo a process called dedifferentiation. Dr. Brown and his colleagues wanted to better understand the signals that induce dedifferentiation, and therefore analyzed samples from patients with dilative cardiomyopathy and acute myocardial infarction. They found that the cytokine oncostatin was upregulated in these samples and was a strong inducer of dedifferentiation. They also found that oncostatin stimulated expression of progenitor markers such as c-KIT and RUNX1. Interestingly, they also found that persistent oncostatin signaling in chronic heart disease led to loss of heart function, but that oncostatin could also protect the heart after infarct.
Hi, this is Thomas Brown.
Hi, Thomas. This is Christina Lilyhook from Cell Stem Cell.
Yeah, hi. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you as well. How are you doing?
Fine.
I wanted to ask you some general questions about your paper, and I thought I could start by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about what happens to a cardiomyocyte that undergoes dedifferentiation.
Yeah, cardiomyocytes usually have to contract really heavily to pump the blood through the organism, but sometimes under such disease conditions, they start to shut down these differentiated functions just to save energy. And that, of course, also has an impact on the contractile force. And so therefore, less blood is pumped by the heart and the whole system just gets less efficient and less more or less reflected by this downregulation of dedifferentiation markers and cardiomyocytes like myosin heavy chain and all these other molecules that make up the striated muscle cell.
Do you think the cardiomyocytes become more like heart stem cells?
I mean, they certainly on a molecular level activate certain molecules that are expressed in cardiac stem cells. I mean, I wouldn't go so far to claim that these so far considered to be postmitotic cardiomyocytes really completely switch to progenitor cells.
What do you think happens in the injured heart that promotes oncostatin regulation? I know you talk a little bit about in the paper how macrophages get recruited. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that people usually do not consider when they think about heart infarction, but the damage that occurs to the parenchyma, to the myocardium, that of course also needs cells, macrophages, to remove all the cellular debris that emerge after this catastrophe of tissue damage. So in this process of invasion of inflammatory cells and this process of inflammation that is required to remove all that stuff that is generated during tissue damage, that usually mediated by macrophages. And they also, of course, interact with the parenchyma.
So do you think the macrophages are secreting the oncostatin?
Or? Yeah, we are pretty sure about that. I mean, when we look at infarction model, for example, as well as in real human patients, we see a lot of macrophages, which has been known for a long time, in the injured area. And these macrophages, they contain large amounts of oncostatin M that you can easily identify by doing immunofluorescence staining.
I was also a little curious about what your thoughts are on the potential translational relevance of these results. For instance, can you see that blocking oncostatin signaling in chronic heart disease could be a viable therapeutic approach?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's something that we also want to pursue, and I'm really confident that that might be an extremely attractive avenue to combat these late stages of dilative cardiomyopathy or prolonged cardiac damage. So that seems to be really something that is relatively specific with OSM signaling in such a disease state, a late inflammatory state, which can be then relatively specifically addressed.
And what are your thoughts about oncostatin treatment after more acute injuries, like infarct?
This also looks very promising. Also, I mean, I know that a lot of people cure heart diseases in mice, and sometimes it's surprising how well, at least what's in the papers, it looks like. But we did a lot of experiments to verify these effects, which are pretty striking. What I, however, have to say, so far we treated our experimental animals both before as well as after injury with OSM. And of course, in a clinical setting, it would be most attractive to have an agent in hand that has a protective effect after the damage has been done. That will be something that we will do in the future to see what time point is essential to see this protective effect in this acute setting. So in other words, is it possible after a certain delay of a day or a couple of hours after infarction to still have this protective function of OSM? Or is it required that you initiate this dedifferentiation before infarction starts?
Well, we look forward to hearing more about those translational efforts, maybe, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Kiki. That was Thomas Brown from the Max Planck Institute for Heart and Lung Research in Bad Nauheim, Germany. You can find the paper just discussed in the November issue of Cell Stem Cell. In our final segment, we turn to the subject of flu vaccines. In a given year, a vaccine's effectiveness depends on the correspondence between which strains the vaccine was targeted to and which strains actually predominate in a given flu season. Now scientists are looking to end this guessing game with the design of new vaccines that are broadly effective against whatever strains might pop up. A recent review in Trends in Immunology discusses these issues in depth, and you'll get a flavor of this in our next interview between the author and Trends in Immunology editor Elizabeth Thompson. Over to you, Liz.
As autumn sets in, the leaves pile up and another flu season begins. Many of us will head to the clinic for our annual flu shot and hope that the vaccine makers successfully predicted which strains and subtypes of the influenza virus will be circulating this year. But with the virus continually mutating and strains occasionally making the leap from other species, the effectiveness of the vaccine is never certain. The holy grail of flu vaccines would be a universal jab that protects long-term against a wide range of influenza strains. A review in the November issue of Trends in Immunology examines recent findings that bring us nearer to this goal. Joining us to tell us more is corresponding author of this review, Dr. Patrick Wilson from the University of Chicago. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi.
So to get started, could you tell us a bit about what you think the main limitations are of the currently available vaccines?
Actually, the vaccine works very well, but it's quite strain specific. And so the limitation is the drift in the antigens or the immunogenicity of the strain that we're vaccinated with. And then because of selective pressure in the population, the virus will alter its envelope protein so that it's no longer effectively neutralized in the population. And so new strains will emerge, and then the vaccine will become, or the previous vaccination will be no longer be protective. And so it's the speed at which flu can change the problem. It's not actually the vaccine itself. And so it ends up being the vaccine is too specific to particular strains.
Your team, as well as other groups, have recently found broadly neutralizing antibodies in humans that can recognize multiple influenza strains. Can you tell us what's so exciting about that discovery?
What's so exciting is that these antibodies are recognizing portions of the virus that are critical for the virus's ability to be virulent or to survive, and therefore these parts of the virus can't change. And so that means that when the virus is pressured by immunization in the population, these regions are conserved both between many different viruses and the viruses that would be able to change other parts of their envelope proteins. How we judge the effectiveness of an influenza vaccine is by the antibodies that are produced. And so the main correlative protection is with neutralizing antibodies, or antibodies that can inhibit the virus's ability to infect cells. And so by discovering antibodies that can bind to many different influenza strains, and also they're binding to these critical functional areas, we can maybe better target the vaccine or alter the vaccine to preferentially induce these kinds of antibodies.
And where next? How do we go from the discovery of broadly neutralizing antibodies to a universal vaccine? And what are the hurdles to making that happen?
I think the hurdles include our ability to more or less direct how our immune system sees the vaccine. And so the current approaches, which are reviewed in our article, that include strategies such as providing vaccination with multiple different influenza strains, they're actually quite different, but they share these very important portions. And so what happens is the idea would be to sort of hone the immune response to target these very specific parts of the virus. And in this way, hopefully we could get a better, what we call in the business, a broadly protective vaccine. The second approach is what we called in this article and a minimalist approach, where people like Peter Pallese's group are making minimalist vaccine structures. So portions of the virus, or portions actually of the hemagglutinin protein on the virus, that are just these highly conserved parts, or as little as possible other portions of the virus, and in this way to hopefully target these very important broadly protective antibodies.
When can we expect to see a new type of vaccine?
Because of the advances that have been made and the identification of these epitopes by various labs, Ian Wilson's lab, Wayne Marasco, and Antonio Lanzavecchia recently, amongst others, have, you know, these, because we know what to target now, and we know what kinds of antibodies we're trying to elicit, it could just be a few years before we see at least vaccines that are being tested in clinical trials. We're actually kind of excited about even the current H1N1 vaccine, because it is the same strain that we had shown can preferentially induce these kinds of antibodies in people that had histories of exposure to annual vaccines. The trick, though, is that, you know, these portions of the virus, we're newly targeting them. I mean, this is the first time we're placing selective pressure really in a directed way on these portions of the virus, and the virus has always won. It's a very adaptable organism.
Well, thank you, Patrick. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Liz. That was Patrick Wilson from the University of Chicago. You can find the review discussed in the November issue of Trends in Immunology. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, you can keep up to date with everything that's happening at Cell and the Cell Press family of journals by following us on Twitter @CellPressNews. I'm Cyrus Martin. Thanks for listening.